I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Mark Riley.
And I'm Rob Hughes.
And you're listening to the A to Z of David Bowie,
the greatest rock and roll star in the world.
Ever.
Ever.
So, where are we going this time, Bob?
E is for Brian Eno.
Well, to be completely correct about this, Bob, Brian Peter George St. John Le Baptiste de La Salle Eno.
Well said.
Yeah, easy for me to say. Mm. And before we go any further, we have mentioned these previously. We will get to them a little bit later on chronologically. But Brian Eno and Peter Schmidt both famously invented what was called the oblique strategy card,
yes,
didn't they?
Yes.
And I've actually bought a set. Now, you're quite jealous, aren't you, Bob?
I am, because I tried to buy a set years ago and they were all sold out. And every time I go to buy a set, they're still sold out.
They just go immediately. Mm. And so they reprint them every now and then, but not often enough.
No, they don't.
So only special people have them.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. But anyway, I get your point, Mark. But
so, all right then, go on, mate.
No, I was just going to say, they are essentially a series of unusual instructions that you could take in an artistic way.
Yeah, and we've, like, brave broadcasters as we are, podcasters, if you like, then we've decided that what we're going to do is actually go into the box.
Yes.
We're going to pull out some of the different cards. But we need to have some kind of honesty and sincerity about this, Bob, because there's no point in pulling these out and then just saying, all right, this is what Eno and Peter say, we've got to do it, and then say, no, I'm not going
to
do it.
We have to apply them.
It's pointless and worthless.
Absolutely. Just as the musicians apply them in the studio, we should apply them here.
So hang on a second. Well, let's do it then.
Are you shuffling them or just taking them as they come?
No, I'll take them as they come. Right. Okay, yeah. And I've never used these in my life, though David Bowie used them, and that's why we're doing all this anyway.
Yes, but,
okay, so first one. All right. What does that say, Bob?
Let's have a look. Go outside, shut the door.
Go outside and shut the door. Well, if it's what Brian wants, then it's what Brian gets, isn't it?
If he says do it, I think you should do it.
I don't know if it helps any.
You did that. That's great.
I mean, it's what Brian and Peter want, isn't it? You know. We'll try another one, Bob.
Okay, next one. What's that one?
Don't be frightened of clichés.
Well, we always think outside the box, don't we, at the end of the day.
We're struggling with that one already, aren't we? Another? Use an old idea. Oh, blimey. Now he's seconding Mickey, and he's been doing that. We've been doing that for years, Bob. Let's have a few more. We'll letter them throughout. Yeah. Okay. Do the words need changing?
Well, we've been through that as well, haven't we?
Yeah, okay. All right, we'll leave them now. Yeah. We'll leave them now. Let's move on to the story of Brian Eno. So it's going to be a bit of a whopper, this one, isn't it?
It is. It's a large story, isn't it? Okay, so Bowie and Eno meet for the first time, 25th of June, 1972. Roxy Music and Trapeze are opening for Bowie at the Greyhound in Croydon.
I've been there. So when I was roadieing for the fall, they were opening for Susie and the Banshees. And that was, again, a kind of a legendary venue for me because I'd heard it being mentioned in the careers of Bowie and also T-Rex and Motley Hoople. So I hadn't been a roadie for the fall for that long. Ooh. Not been to any venues in London apart from to watch Bowie, funnily enough.
Yeah.
And so ended up going there in 1970. It would have been early 1978. Probably.
Roxy had been recommended to Bowie by his mate, Mark Pritchett, who'd gone to Dulwich College with the guitar player, Phil Manzanera.
There were 1,000 fans turned away that night, so it's obviously the momentum has really started going for Bowie there. But yeah, the 19th and 20th of August 1972, Roxy Music famously support Bowie at the Rainbow Theatre in Finsbury Park.
Okay, so let's get a bit of a bio when it comes to Brian Eno. Born in Woodbridge, Suffolk, 15th of May 1948. Father William Arnold Eno is a postman.
Yeah.
His mother Maria Alphonsine Eno. I mean, a lot of people just think Eno is a bit of a stage name, but it isn't, as we, you know, this is his real name.
Well, I'd never never heard of anybody else called Eno apart from his brother. But I mean, some research into it shows that it derives from the French Huguenot name Hino, H-E-N-N-O-T. And it is quite common in soil. All right there, Eno. Is that how they speak and stuff?
I think they do, yeah. Right, okay. Yeah. So Roxy Music themselves formed in November 1970 by Brian Ferry, who was an unemployed ceramics teacher at the time, wasn't he? Right. And bassist Graham Simpson, Andy Mackay joined later and introduced an old university mate, Eno, to the band.
Yeah, he was described at that point in time as a non-musician. So he wasn't supposed to be in the band. He was supposed to be like, you know, an extra, a boffin kind of thing, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
And, you know, he could play the synth, which wasn't that hard, let's be honest. And he owned a Revox reel-to-reel tape recorder. So you're in, it's a little bit like, you know, if you've got a van.
Yeah.
We've been through these things before, you know. If you've got a van or if your dad has got a garage that you can rehearse in, then you've got a good chance of joining the band, like on tambourine.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, there's those great stories, aren't there, about the Roxy Music van, and everybody would be reading, like, The Enemy and Melody Maker, and he'd be having, like, scientific journals and all that stuff, you know, like devouring these tomes.
Brilliant. But, yeah, he was called a technical advisor, wasn't he? Such a fantastic band, and they were so great to watch. I remember seeing them doing Virginia Plain on Top of the Pops, and that, I mean, it wasn't up there with Bowie doing Star Man for me personally, but it was mind-blowing. I mean, if you were looking at T-Rex, they were doing it, Motley Hoople, still not gone really glam when I saw them doing All the Young Dudes with that clip on Top of the Pops, but they looked incredible. They looked wilder probably than Bowie and the Spiders, and the song is great. They are one of my favourite bands and one of the great bands, but I think part and parcel of the fact that they were so good to look at was the start of the end for Eno, in a way.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have, you know, as you say, they all come from art school and the rest of it. So they've got the visual aesthetic going on. You've got Brian Ferry, who I imagine would probably think, oh, I'm the bee's knees here. Everybody's going to be kind of just looking at me. Everybody was great to look at. But on the other side of the stage, of course, you've got Eno there, who's equally brilliant in his little leopard skin robes and the rest of it. Just this unusual character. So it's sort of, when it came to the fan base, it kind of split, didn't it? There were two Brians in that band.
There were, and you know, the funny thing is, obviously, Brian Ferry would be either just strutting his stuff or playing the piano, but Eno behind all these gadgets, making all these weird and wonderful noises, and with that long hair and those crazy costumes. There's a really brilliant documentary about Brian Eno, and he put it online, it would have been probably early January, and it's a 20-minute documentary about making Here Come the Warm Jets. And there's loads of stuff on there. Chris Spedding's in there recording some stuff for the album. But it also shows the woman who made his costumes. She's got his costumes behind her and stuff like that. And it's a brilliant documentary. Just throwing that in, people really should watch it. But with Brian Eno being so interesting and Brian Ferry being what he thought was the focal point in the band, that's a story. There was a frisson of jealousy.
Yeah, there was. And I have it on authority from a pretty famous musician who was there at the time. I won't name him, but he said, look, he was literally told, you know, Brian Ferry did issue an ultimatum of sorts to Eno, to say, look, there is only one Brian in this band.
Right, okay. Now, the irony being that Brian Ferry, as we know, was a massive fan of the Velvet Underground.
Yeah.
Okay, and so, and not quite a template, you wouldn't go perhaps that far, but his favourite band anyway. Mm. And what happened with the Velvet Underground, we know that Lou Reed ended up getting jealous of John Cale's profile within the band, because once again, he was perceived to be the interesting one.
Yeah.
The long black hair, the shades, the very beatniky kind of dress sense that he had, playing the viola, and obviously turning things on its head, and Lou Reed was playing the guitar and being a bit straight, and he didn't like the fact that he wasn't the vocal point of the band, and got rid of John Cale. So, I mean, even down to not only kind of imitating the template of the Velvet Underground, he also imitated the frisson of jealousy.
Yeah, absolutely. Jealous imitator. Wow, what are the chances? Well, the interesting thing, of course, is obviously Roxy went on to have a fantastic career. So this sort of split, Eno's suddenly a solo artist, as you just mentioned, Here Come the Warm Jets. It's a wonderful piece of work, recorded September 73, released in January 74. All of Roxy are on there, apart from
Brian Ferry. I would imagine Brian Eno said, there's only one Brian in this band. But Chris Spedding's on there, just one of the great guitarists. Yeah. Buster Cherry Jones, who went on to play with Gang of Four and Talking Heads and all other people. John Wetton, King Crimson and Roxy Music, funnily enough.
Yeah.
Lloyd Watson, who had appeared with Bowie and Roxy Music at the Rainbow as well. And Robert Fripp.
Yeah, whose other career was intertwined with Eno's for a long time, doing the experimental ambient recordings, wasn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, and this is a really important part as well, because Eno's work on Babies on Fire is incendiary and just remarkable. And obviously, that was pretty much one of the points in Eno's life where he just noted, this guy is so great, we need to work together. And he does, as we'll find out, but he also gets introduced to Bowie.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a word about the friendship with Robert Fripp. I mean, I'm lucky enough to meet both of them and interview both of them, and Fripp has this thing where, I mean, he was great, which we will get to later on in the series, but you know, he could talk for a long time. If you want him to talk about a specific subject, he is off and he will give you everything that you want. So we were doing this, and then at the end I'd brought along a couple of albums for him to sign, as you'd imagine, one of them being No Pussyfooting, which is the one with Eno, and he did say to me very, very politely, oh, you know, I don't you? And obviously he has this thing where he didn't want to put his autograph out so people can sell them on eBay and the rest, and I respect that and all the rest of it.
Sure.
So he said, I'll tell you what I will do. I also, at this point, perhaps as a bit of leverage, I used to take around these very, very old-fashioned autograph books and get them signed for my two kids. So anybody I ever met, you know, they would sign this thing. So I did say, oh, what about these, you know, for my kids? And they're only, you know, 10, 11. I said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. And he opened both books and he signed, but instead of writing Robert Fripp, he signed Brian Eno. How's that? And he signed my album, Brian Eno. So when I met Eno, which would be about maybe 18 months after this, I told him this story. He found it quite funny. And he said, I'll tell you what I'll do.
Here we go.
And he signed it Robert Fripp. So I have this album at home, which is signed by both of them, but not in their handwriting.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Just
absolutely
wonderful.
Brilliant. I mean, I met Robert Fripp. I met him twice, funny enough. The first time I met him, he wasn't aware of the fact that he'd met me. But Peter Gabriel was playing at the Hammersmith Odeon,
as it
will be forever known to us lot. And we went down the sides of the stage door and a bit awestruck, even just then thinking about Bowie. So it'd be 1977, I think.
Mm.
And I just said to my mate, I'm going in. So I was 16, threw my denim jacket over my shoulder, thinking that would make me automatically look like a roadie,
right,
even though I still wasn't shaving.
Yeah.
And I was going down all the little catacombs and everything. And then I just ended up on the stage. It was just like, I was like, oh my God, I'm on the same stage that the Ziggy's Last Stand. And, and it blew my mind. And then just out of nowhere, there was a little tap on the shoulder. And I turned around and Robert Fripp sat on a stool with his Black Beauty, Gibson Les Paul, in his lap, and his amp beside him. And I just turned around and went, yeah, mate. And he said, would you mind just moving over slightly that way? I'm trying to communicate with the sound man. Sure thing, mate. And then scarpered as quick as I possibly could. And that was Robert Fripp.
Oh.
And that tour, he played behind a curtain.
Mm.
So you couldn't see him play.
Ah, is that right?
Yeah, so the whole band were there to be seen. And you would think, oh, where's that coming from? Where's that noise coming from? What's that guitar like? Where's that? Who's doing that? And it was Robert Fripp, and he was hiding away. He didn't want to take any of the attention away from Peter Gabriel.
Wow, I didn't realise he's behind a curtain. That's a bit like that story about Jimi Hendrix going on stage with Engelbert Humperdinck, isn't it? And playing behind a curtain.
Oh, did he?
He didn't want to take Engelbert's glow away from him.
Well, who would?
Well,
who would? Absolutely.
I wouldn't.
And the other time we met him was when he came and did the Frippertronics on the Radio 1 programme with Mark Ratcliffe and I, which was great. But yeah, so that's I've met him twice. But he is great. At the end of the doing the Frippertronics night, the phone went. It was midnight, and there was a hello. Who's that? It's Mark Riley here. Can I help? Oh yes, it's Toya here. Could I possibly have a chat with Robert?
Oh, how sweet.
Yeah, of course you can. Robert, your wife's on the phone. Great memory for me.
Just great. Going back to Eno then. Where are we? So his second solo album, Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy, released November 1974. So he's on a roll here. He's releasing, you know, a couple of albums a year. And by this time, of course, he's a creative force. He gets onto Bowie's radar as an artist as well at the same time.
Third album, Another Green World, that was released in the September of 75. And that was getting more and more minimalist, wasn't it? You know, and more towards what became known as ambient music, which is so associated with.
Yeah, and the title track, of course, was under the theme tune for Arena, which is the BBC 2 programme, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's only about 2 minutes long, the piece, isn't it? But it's really, really beautiful.
Yeah.
And it was also discreet music as well.
Yeah, so those two albums really kind of pivotal. So Bowie met up with Eno one day at his Wembley, when he was playing Wembley in May 76, which I know you were lucky enough to go and see.
Yeah.
And started, you know, thinking about what can I do with this guy? How can we collaborate in a way that's really meaningful and different?
And the thing is, I love this because, as we know, Bowie had been financially strapped for cash, you know, and the Berlin years and all that, where they were talking about not having enough money to do what they want to do. Yeah. But even then, this is Brian Eno described the fact that he thought that Bowie was trying to duck having a hugely successful career.
Yeah.
He just wanted to be adventurous, and so he wanted to make enough money to live and hopefully, you know, to live comfortably.
Mm.
But he wanted to take a lot of risks as well and not just take the easy route. And you could argue that maybe he did that, but did it brilliantly with Let's Dance.
Yes.
But he certainly wasn't ready for it in 1976.
No, he wasn't, certainly. But, you know, he had the opportunity, as you say, he could have kind of taken the money, could have done the really obvious thing and just peddled the old hits and the rest of it. We wasn't interested in that at all. We should also mention one of the things that turned Eno onto ambient music. He was involved in a car accident. He was knocked over by a car, wasn't he? And whilst he was reconvening, there was a rotten old mono stereo set that he was listening to, and that gave him the first sort of ideas of perhaps there's something in this, we could do some ambient music.
Yeah, it was a stereo setup, but part of it wasn't working, so he was just getting various little feeds coming through here and there, but by no means a full picture, and he liked it.
Yeah.
And so he thought, right, well, I'm going to run with this one, you know. He's such a brilliant, adventurous character, and the two of them together, we mentioned before that they say that they would only ever talk in Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, Derek and Clive voices, and great. All that kind of stuff.
And we, you know, as a measure of Eno's importance to Bowie, I know Tony Visconti has described Eno as Bowie's Zen master, hasn't he?
Yeah.
So he's there, this kind of guiding force.
So we started off using the oblique strategies, didn't we, Bobby? I'll just let me get another one here.
Oh, go on, mate.
Something boring. We've been doing that.
Well, we're on it.
Yeah. We're experts at that, you know. Don't you tell us our job. We've got them all here. Like I say, what's the next one? Don't break the silence. Well, we do that occasionally.
Yeah.
Give way to your worst impulse.
Oh.
You know, that's the lead card off it.
Okay, that's a long one.
How would you have done it?
Right.
Honour thy error as a hidden intention.
Ah, that's a good one. That was used on Low, wasn't it? I know that was used.
Yeah, absolutely. Repetition is a form of change.
Mm,
so, and you know, and emphasise the flaws was a very important one. And also use an unacceptable colour, which reminds me of Tony Hancock in The Rebel, where they ask him about what he thinks of a certain painting and he's bluffing his way through. And he said, well, to me, the colours are the wrong shape.
The wrong shape. Brilliant.
And everybody loves it.
Honour thy error as a hidden intention.
Yeah, that's what
stuff
just mentioned.
Like that. Oh,
yeah,
of course.
Absolutely.
So, as I say, all this stuff is going on, really just to get the thought process different. People sort of being more intuitive in the studio. That was what it's all about. And it certainly worked for Bowie, didn't it?
It did.
Various examples going on here. There is, of course, Boys Keep Swinging, which I love, which has the most weird instrumental break. That's because the Oblique Strategies card sort of instructed everybody to swap instruments.
Yeah, well, I think they didn't all swap, did they? But I know Carlos Alomar plays drums on it.
Yeah.
And Dennis Davies plays bass on it. And so, as we know, the rhythm section to a record is the core of it, isn't it? Mm. That's what it's all based on. And so that's really shaking it up by making... Because like Carlos Alomar, you know, musicians can generally play other instruments, but obviously not as well as their first instrument, generally speaking.
Yeah.
So he can hold the beat down and... But it's got this really great kind of garage feel to it, almost like it's a youngster playing it because he'd not actually, you know, he'd not become kind of studio session musician proficiency or
whatever. That's right, yeah. It's very visceral, isn't it? So Bowie had said of Eno, Brian really opened my eyes to the idea of processing to the abstract of communication. So you can see this on Low, recorded, you know, September and October 1976 at the Chateau d'Hérouville, just outside Paris, produced by Tony Visconti, but massive contributions from Brian Eno.
Yeah, and it's great. He's never claimed to be the producer or anything else, but he's gone in there and done a really important job on the whole thing. He even got a writing credit on Warzawa, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. There was a story that circulated around that time that the chateau was haunted, wasn't it? One particular room that was haunted by the ghost of, I can't think
Elton
who it was.
John.
Elton John, that's who it was. He'd been there a few years before, hadn't he? And Eno had this room, and Bowie had said, there's a corner of that room where it just stays dark all the time, no matter when the sun's flying through. It's all. So I asked Eno about this. Obviously, the real pressing stuff that everybody wants to know, and he said he had no idea. He doesn't recollect. He said the thing started as a story that maybe Visconti half remembered, and like a lot of things, it just gathers a bit of pace, like a snowball over the years. As far as he could remember, he wasn't woken up in the middle of the night and didn't scream, as Visconti may have mentioned in the past.
So they won't be making a film about that episode in his life,
will
they?
Nothing to show whatsoever.
So heroes, the same team, the same roles, really, you know. But the important point, which we alluded to earlier on, was when David Bowie wanted a guitarist, and Brian Eno says, why not I give Robert Fripp a call?
And I think Fripp was in New York at the time with Peter Gabriel, wasn't he? And he just said, look, you've got the instruction, we want to come to Berlin to play some hairy rock and roll.
Yeah, we kind of covered that a little bit in the Berlin thing, didn't we? But again, you mentioned the oblique strategy cards were in there. He worked on Lodger as well, which was the last LP that Bowie worked with on Eno until One Outside, which came out in 1995. Again, the flash cards, all that kind of stuff, you know. But I love this. When they were doing that, he said to Reeve Gabrels, he gave him the instruction to give him some motivation. He said, okay, you are the disgruntled member of a South African rock band. Play the notes that were suppressed.
Oh, I love that.
Which, he's funny.
And of course, Bowie, Eno is credited as producer on that, alongside Bowie and co-producer David Richards. Eno obviously patently loved Bowie. I mean, one of the things, when I did meet Eno, one of the things I was told, as often happens when you interview somebody of that sort of magnitude, don't talk about Roxy, don't talk about Bowie. They were the two instructions from his sort of PR people. And of course, you're there and you think, can I slip something in here? He willingly talked about Roxy and the Velvet Underground and the influence of all of the art school and all that kind of stuff. And we got to Bowie and he was talking about singers and how they adopt this sort of method acting way of performing. And he said the perfect example was Bowie. So of course, you know, we're in. And he talked about watching him in the studio during Outside and just inhabiting, becoming these characters. And he said it was a real lesson for Eno in that you could sort of, you know, become something you weren't, but you could make yourself into another being to enhance the song you were working on. It sort of went that deep, you know.
That's the actor thing, isn't it, in Bowie, which he has admitted, you know, he's just adopting characters, which, you know, everybody knows that kind of stuff anyway. But, I mean, he's always on Twitter. He's always so fond of Bowie. And there's this here as well, which relates to David Bowie's death as experienced by Brian Eno. So while Bowie's death came as a surprise to Eno, the producer revealed that Bowie hinted that he knew his time left was short in their last correspondence. I received an email from him 7 days ago. It was funny as always and as surreal, looping through word games and allusions and all the usual stuff we did. It ended with this sentence, "Thank you for our good times, Brian. They will never rot." And it was signed Dawn, D-A-W-N. And Eno ends his statement, "I realise now he was saying goodbye."
I mean, he would sign off with these invented names, wouldn't he? Like Mr. Showbiz, Milton Keynes, Rhoda Borax, and the Duke of Ear.
Rhoda Borax. I didn't know that. I'm going to nick that one.
Oh, that's so great.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Rob Hughes and Mark Riley.
E is for the Edgar Broughton Band.
So we're looking at like David Bowie's life through the microscope here and both finding out loads of things that we didn't know. And as you would expect, somebody was so steeped in music. He was going to all the rock and roll clubs. He was really mad on the Pretty Things and the Stones and this all the Anthony Newley stuff as well. Yeah. All very, very kind of confusing and eclectic, you would have to say. But one of the bands that he did have some dealings with were the Edgar Broughton Band. Yeah. Now, I may have mentioned this previously, but I did go and see the Edgar Broughton Band. It was a science teacher, Mr. Sheridan, took us all to the Hard Rock, which Bowie had opened.
I can't get over that. So a science teacher, well,
part he knew Edgar Broughton.
Oh, I see. All right.
And so, and we were like probably, I don't know, 16 at the time. He said, "Yeah, I'm going to go to this gig. Any of you fancy it?" And knowing that we love music, and we went, and it was the only time we went to the Hard Rock, and it was very. It was very, very gnarly, the
was
set.
It?
Yeah, it really was. But, you know, so the first record that I can find of Bowie and Edgar Broughton meeting each other, possibly, anyway, was an eight-hour benefit concert at Middle Earth in Covent Garden on the 19th of May, 1968. And it was a benefit for a hippie cafe called Gandalf's Garden.
This is quite famous, isn't it? Run by a guy called Muzz Murray, who also published an underground magazine of the same name. I believe now Muzz Murray can be found touring the world as, and I quote, a mantra master, whatever
really?
That is.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. All right,
also on the bill that night, Tyrannosaurus Rex, Junior's Eyes, of course, have their own Bowie connotation. Edgar Broughton, Third Ear Band, Hapshash and the Coloured Coat, and the compere, John Peel, of course.
Omnipresent, yeah. So, David performs his Tibetan mime routine, okay, and to music being pumped through the PA. So that was actually just for Bowie, at least, a trial run, because he had a big show coming up at the Royal Festival
Hall.
Yeah,
that's right. I also understand that when Edgar Broughton Band played the Brighton Dome, so this would be about a year, sort of 1969, Bowie was sort of bottom of the bill doing his mime thing, but he did get on stage with them later on when the power went off, apparently, and did a little jam.
Right, okay. Yeah. Another one was when Bowie was playing with Just Mick Ronson on bass, and I think that might have been August 1970, Southend on Sea anyway, so Rock with Shelter, and Bowie gets up and does some mime with him.
Yeah, so at that time, okay, so it, as you say, threw some mime shapes. He'd done previously, sort of like, you might say that Bowie was almost a sort of prototype of Stacia from Hawkwind, but with less visuals, perhaps.
And more clothes, probably, yeah. Certainly. Also on the bill was Fat Harry.
Yeah.
Roger Ruskin Spear of the Bonzos, Surly Bird.
Surly Bird turned into Kersal Flyers, didn't they?
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Oh, right,
yeah.
Okay, great. And Michael Chapman, who we love Michael Chapman, don't we?
Oh, yes.
A fully qualified survivor. He's got a legion of wonderful albums. His last album's called 50, so great.
Yeah.
But on Fully Qualified Survivor, he did have Mick Ronson playing guitar.
Mm.
And the story is, as I understand it, that Bowie did ask Michael Chapman to join his band at one point, and he recommended Ronson.
That's right.
One way around that I've heard it. So John Cambridge also recommended Ronson to Bowie. So I don't know. But anyway, Michael Chapman said of Bowie about him doing the mime within all of this. He said, it's a bit strange for an audience that had come out for live music and the sunshine. So
absolutely. Well, you know, whatever they made of it. It was the times. So we go on now to the 19th of June, 1971, billed as the Macrobiotic Festival, which really is Glastonbury, isn't it? Which we will talk about.
Yeah.
In G.
Yeah.
On the bill that day, Hawkwind, Arthur Brown, Fairport, Gong, Traffic, Brinsley Schwartz, and of course, Edgar Broughton Band.
Yeah, so I mean, there will be lots of bands that you could mention who have just in passing kind of had some dealings with David Bowie or shared a bill. This podcast would not be, I don't know, anything between 30 and 40 episodes. It'd be a few hundred.
Yeah, of course.
So we'll spare everybody that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one thing that kind of perplexes a lot of Bowie fans. If you're looking at a photograph of the famous post-Ziggy show.
Yes.
Okay, you can look round and you can see all the people on there. So you've got Ringo Starr and his wife Maureen. You've got Lulu there. Jeff Beck's there. Naturally, he'd been performing. There's a model there, Celia Hammond. Bianca Jagger is there.
Yeah.
Bowie and Angie Bowie, of course. And there's a very drunk-looking character in a white silk jacket. And he's got a lace top on and a rose in his lapel. And everybody going, who's that?
Yeah.
Who's that there? And even in some books that have got, you know, hugely respected books, I have it down in one particular one as Cat Stevens.
Yeah, but it's not. And there are various kind of poses here, but the most famous one you've got, it is, of course, Edgar Broughton. And he's sort of looking a bit wild, as you say, worse for wear, this big bushy beard and hair all over the place. I think it might be a carnation in his jacket. And there's a wonderful shot of him. He's just above Ringo. And Ringo sat down and Edgar's just up there. And it looks like he's just about to kind of barf on Ringo's head.
He doesn't look well at all. But then again, he'd not been like Jeff Beck had been working that night and everybody else had kept themselves together. But Edgar Broughton was just obviously, very, very obviously on a jolly. And we need to mention also there is one other guy in the photograph. We don't know who that is. If anybody knows who the other guy is who isn't Edgar Broughton, then please drop us a line. You know, you can get hold of us on Twitter.
Yeah,
anyway.
It was really puzzling me that. I did try and find out. So the shot is you've got on the back row, you've got Bowie next to Angie, and then next to Angie is this mystery man. So let's find out who it was. But 73 is an interesting year for Edgar Broughton and Bowie. Because I know Bowie admired his guitar prowess, and there was a story that he asked his manager to get hold of Edgar to play guitar on the sessions for Diamond Dogs, specifically Candidate.
Right, okay.
So, I mean, it didn't happen for whatever reason.
Well, I mean, he's obviously a fan of the band anyway, and previous to all this, maybe even the reason that they'd rekindled this friendship or whatever, and him being at the party and all that kind of stuff. But he had wanted just before for the Edgar Broughton band to back Iggy Pop on Raw Power.
Which Bowie was producing, of course.
Which Bowie was producing. In the end, he didn't. He got James Williamson and the other Stooges. So yeah, obviously a mutual respect there.
The A to Z of David Bowie, with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
E is for Ernie Johnson.
Now, this was a David Bowie play for radio or TV.
That's right,
Or was it film and TV?
I think it was possibly film, radio and TV. Anything wasn't quite sure.
Yeah, well, anyway, the following information we need to credit, as we always do, various people, but Nick Pegg's brilliant book, The Complete David Bowie, which gets up, if you don't know it, it's just like so methodical and brilliant. It's got everything in there that you need to know, really. Yeah. And he updates it as Bowie's career unfolds. Now, of course, David is no longer with us. I don't know whether there'll be any more Complete David Bowies or whether he will need to keep on top of all of the stuff that gets released posthumously.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sure.
But Ernie Johnson. So this is what Nick Pegg writes in his book. Although mentioning Kenneth Pitt's memoir, The Pitt Report, Bowie's unrealised 1968 rock opera, in inverted commas, remained an almost complete mystery until a tape of it came up for auction at Christie's in 1996.
Mm.
It went unsold and has yet to see the light of day. But details of 10 songs emerged in the pages of Record Collector around the same time. Under the collective title Ernie Johnson, the linking narrative seems every bit as tenuous as a non-linear gothic drama hypercycle of One Outside, and its colourful parade of characters bears a superficial similarity to the style of rock opera projects devised by Bowie's sometimes idols, The Who.
It is worth mentioning at this point that obviously Bowie loved The Who, of course, and so in 66, so this is a couple of years after that, The Who had done a mini-opera, well, Pete Townsend mini-opera called A Quick One While He's Away, which is, a bit of a prototype for this. Also in 68, the year of Ernie Johnson, you've got The Pretty Things, another major Bowie influence, doing SF Sorrow, which to me is still the best, out Tommy's Tommy, it's still the best rock opera in my view.
Well, it's deemed to be the first rock opera,
yes,
isn't it?
Certainly.
So, I mean, I don't know if anybody's got any kind of proper timelines on it, but that's the way it's presented anyway.
So the story, as we understand it, or as explained by Nicholas Pegg in his book about Ernie Johnson, Ernie Johnson, 19, invites friends to a party at which he intends to commit suicide. One of the guests, Tiny Tim, describes it as a most exquisite party, darlings. Everyone was there. They busted me for masquerading as a man. And Ernie reminisces about past loves. He has a racist conversation with a tramp. He addresses himself in a mirror and he takes a trip to Carnaby Street to buy a tie in which to kill himself. So it's not the cheeriest scenario.
It's really dark, isn't it? And again, it's not known whether Bowie had Tiny Tim, as in Tiptoe Through the Tulips, in mind with this, or whether it's something else altogether, but it's a bit bizarre. But the songs that were within there, there's one called Where's the Lou? Which is probably not, I mean, not having heard it, I can't profess to know whether it would be David Bowie's finest hour or not.
Right.
Probably not, but it's said to prefigure Queen Bitch anyway.
I wonder if it's a sort of play on words of Lou Reed. I wonder if it's a sort of references him somehow.
Well, yeah, you could be right. About it. Yeah, good point, Bobbert. Other songs, Season Folk, Just One Moment, Sir, which is apparently the racist tramp song.
Right.
Various Times of Day. Mm. And also the last three songs are Ernie Boy, a monologue in which Ernie addresses himself in the mirror while smoking a joint, including the surprising foretaste of Modern Love in his spoken introduction. I'm not running away. I know who I am. I know what I'm made of. This is my day. And a final untitled number.
Okay, so the 35-minute Ernie Johnson tape, probably dated February 68, was accompanied by a 5-page manuscript detailing camera shots, stage directions, all that kind of stuff, suggesting that Bowie, did envisage this, as you mentioned, as a film or television play. So he had the idea in his head, all preformed.
And it was recorded, actually, at David Bowie's home, wasn't it?
Yeah,
on a 4-track recorder as well. And what does it say here? It said it features a surprisingly sophisticated multi-track recording with layered vocal overdubs and expansive instrumentation. Ernie Johnson clearly offers compelling evidence that Bowie's consistent preoccupation with theatrical acts and self-immolation did not begin with Rock and Roll Suicide.
It's interesting, we've discussed it, haven't we? This idolising Tony Newley for so long, and he finally gets to sort of do his rock opera with Diamond Dogs. Obviously, it was just itching away at Bowie for many years, wasn't
constantly,
it?
Constantly, constantly. And kudos and everything to Nick Pegg. Good work, fella.
Mm.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Rob Hughes and Mark Riley.
Is for extras.
Hey, now, Bob, leave it. Oh, I see what you mean. No, extras. Yes, a TV programme.
Yeah, what else would I mean?
Oh, for goodness sake.
So we're talking about Ricky Gervais here, of course. Bowie appeared on Extras in 2006. People familiar with the programme itself, there's a show within a show called When the Whistle Blows, which was Ricky Gervais's character Andy had this awful, really nasty early 70s style sitcom that nobody liked, but was popular for some reason. But everybody else, all the press and everybody else, were just slagging it off really badly.
Well, see, I never really got into this programme, though I did watch the episode with Bowie. But I mean, I was well aware, obviously, The Office, I did enjoy that an awful lot. But it was brought to our attention whilst The Office was up and running.
Yes.
That Ricky Gervais had been, I think it was the social sec at Yulu, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
And he managed the band Suede.
Yeah.
For an early part of their career. And of course, Suede was so influenced by David Bowie. And indeed, there was a front cover shot, wasn't there, of Brett Anderson and David Bowie.
That's right.
So even then, the signs were there that he was a big Bowie fan.
Definitely. I mean, he idolised Bowie growing up. He said he put my life in colour. He made me believe you can do anything you want to do. There is one story about him going to see Bowie at his apartment in New York and being greeted with this sort of 3D Picasso-esque sculpture in the middle of the room and being really amazed by it, this beautiful piece of art. And Bowie just coming up and said, yeah, how'd you like it? Oh, yeah, my daughter likes to hit that with a hammer.
Right,
you know,
okay.
He's had this attitude. So, of course, he's preparing this episode of Extras. He thinks, right, I'll give Bowie a ring. And he phoned Bowie up and said, look, I'd like you to do this little cameo. It's a little bit improvised, but really it's sort of centred around a song that you do. Can you do me a version of Life on Mars or something retro like that?
Right.
Of course, Bowie's saying, well, yeah, OK, I'll just knock another one of those out for you.
You see, now, the very telling part about this is that I knew David Bowie a little bit, and I met him 9 times, might have been 10 times. But that is the way he was. He was so affable and not kind of self-aware, really. He was just a really, really genuinely nice fella who was game for a laugh and had lots of mischief in him.
Yeah.
So you would imagine that a lot of people think of David Bowie, you just ring him up and say, oh, you do this thing where you make a bit of a twerp of yourself on the programme, and Bowie thinking, I'm David Bowie, excuse me.
Yeah.
No. Like, yeah, sure, mate, no bother.
Yeah, well, that was a great thing that Gervais said. He said it wasn't like he was talking to David Bowie. It was just David Jones, you know, from Brixton. It was just another guy, you know, he'd led this incredible life. In fact, to talk about mischief and the rest of it, he said when he did phone him up, obviously he was really nervous about phoning Bowie up. There was a long, long pause before he picked up the phone. His first words were, sorry, I was eating a banana.
Right.
So imagine that, how great.
Okay.
So he's on Extras and he's sat at the piano at some industry bash. The scene has him, Bowie, sort of making or improvising this song based around Ricky Gervais's character, Andy. And of course, you know, it's called Little Fat Man, and the lyrics about chubby little loser with his pug-nosed face, sold his soul for a shot of fame and all the rest of it. It's just some horrible derogatory put-down about this character, and Bowie's just off with it. And everybody else is laughing, of course, apart from Ricky Gervais's character, who's just shame-faced in the corner.
Did Bowie write the song?
I believe he did.
The A to Z of David Bowie was written and presented by Rob Hughes and Mark Riley and recorded and edited by Howard Knock. If you'd like to review or rate this podcast, well, that would be much appreciated. In the next episode...
Fame. Susie Fussy.
Freddie Beretti.
Fashion.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.